I really appreciated the comments of everyone who was able to be here. Last year we had a big meeting to kind of look at what we're doing together. We had the foil of this decision about what time to meet, but it really seemed to bring in a lot more than just what time. You know, what are we really trying to do together? You know, why do we come or not come? And there seemed to be a tremendous sort of energy of sort of commitment to our life and to the practice. It was really great. Maybe in the end we won't change a thing, but just having the meeting was great. And I also want to thank again I think four people gave talks while I was not on sabbatical this summer. And so far I've listened to some of Edie's talk on the Eightfold Noble Truth and some of John's talk on preferences, and I'm looking forward to hearing, I think, Kate and Joan, I think, said some words. I haven't listened yet. But what I've heard, the talks I've heard so far were great, you know, so practical and grounded, you know, and straightforward. That through the format and the forms and the meditation, we do access something mysterious. There certainly does seem to be a feeling or a sense that there's more to this life than what we can talk about or understand. And it's so helpful to have some way of being with that together. And yet it's easy to misunderstand this whole process as if it were all mysterious and impossible to understand. You have to be like a high holy person or go to a monastery for 20 years to do more than just sort of play around. And so I appreciated John and Edie's talks being very practical. And I'm hoping to follow in their excellent examples and be a little bit more practical. There are things we can do, you know. Teachings that come to us through the tradition that are really helpful. For each of us, they'll be expressed or understood a little differently because we can only express things through our own life, right? Our own experience. You can't express something through somebody else's life. And we also had a speaker on Saturday who was the same way, very accessing the mystery but also very practical, Anita Feng from Blue Heron Zen Community, which is a Korean Zen practice center, came, and it was wonderful how many similarities there were. It was the same feeling and the same way of talking about the Dharma, even though it came from a different cultural tradition. And of course she's a white Jewish lady, you know, from New England, so. And she loves that about herself, actually. She was telling me, before, we were chatting a little bit before, she said, I love how much I blend in. Nobody would know, you know? And she's like one below the highest level in their system, you know? And a pretty important person in the Korean Zen world. And yeah, she just dresses normally and looks like a Jewish grandmother from New England, which she is. And so, you know, we can look at, so we often use the metaphor of path, right? Of the path. And so the path doesn't do you much good if you don't walk on it, right? It's nice that there's a path and we can appreciate the path and have nice pictures of the path, interesting like calligraphies of the path and read books about the path. But then the path is outside, you know. So we actually have to walk. How do we walk? And in a literal way, it's nice that Bob could come tonight because he is taking some people walking starting on Friday. They're going to walk silently around Mount Rainier, 100 miles. I wonder how many steps that is. I should send you with a pedometer. I'll probably like max it out, you know. And to try to take each step, you know, each step of that journey as a step on the path. Yeah, seven people signed up. Isn't that amazing? Never done this before. So, thank you to Bob for being sort of nutty enough to say yes to that. Because you never know who's going to respond, right? That's the other thing about walking on the path, is if you take a step on the path, you don't know. We think we're so self-focused, right? Think about it. We're so self-focused. We think about, well, is this good for me? But then we step onto the path because we think it's good for us, and maybe it is. But then maybe we look over our shoulder and we see, oh, you know, we help somebody else take a step on the path. So So we talked about that when we were talking about what time to practice last week. It was wonderful. Quite a few people said, well, this is a little better for me, but more important is what's better for you. So it's beautiful. So tonight I wanted to introduce a collection of teachings, you know, like a possible way of engaging with the Buddhist path. And it's a list of lists. And as you know, the Buddhist teachings were famous for their lists, partly because of the way they survived in oral form for so many centuries. Centuries, you know, way longer than America has been in existence. Monks and nuns recited this, like, you know, I don't know how many volumes, this huge amount of material, kept it alive just from memory. And it's easy to remember something if it's a list of eight, because then you can just check yourself. Well, I only said seven. Wait a minute. Ah. So Buddhism is famous for its lists. And to us, lists don't have quite the same feeling as they might have had for somebody who was doing a recitation practice and saying this list, reciting this list, chanting this list, devoting themselves to this list. And I've always assumed they would have different monks or nuns who would specialize in different parts of the material, because how else would they, you know? And so when we look at a list, we usually see it on paper. And pretty much looks like a to-do list to us, which we do not have such spiritual associations with, probably. Because what is the nature of a to-do list? Failure, right? That's the nature of a to-do list. And we, of course, can learn to live with that and appreciate that and understand that that's not a problem. But that's a strong association. So we see this Buddhist list and we know, uh-oh, we're doomed for failure. I guess Aniti's talk, you must have put up a chart or something. Yeah. Which is good.
It wasn't a list.
Yeah. And you said something like, on, you know, on paper it just looks kind of dead, you know. And we have to bring it to life. And so the teaching I want to bring up, it's called, it has a fancy-sounding name, which I like the name, and we will enjoy it. The name is Bodhipakshika Dharma, the name in Sanskrit for this list of lists. So it's a list of seven lists, and it comprises 37 steps, 37 points. Not exactly 37 things on our to-do list, but 37 things we could attend to and practice with. And the way it's understood is that it's both sequential and circular at the same time. And each one of the 37 somehow includes the other 36. So it's also, I don't know what the right adjective is for that. We probably don't have an English adjective for that because we don't believe in that, you know. That one thing could include everything else. Maybe that's ecology. Maybe that's ecology. And it's maybe not the best list. There's, I'm sure, other lists, and you could probably make up a better list. And we could always improve on anything that we receive, right? That's the other thing that we think, you know, the self thinks it can do. It can always improve things, right? But at some point we have to commit to something, right? If we're always improving something before we commit to it, are we ever going to really commit to it? Because another quality of the Buddha's teachings that's interesting is he had a fairly long teaching career, much longer than Jesus, I think much longer than Muhammad, but I don't really know. And he had a very responsive style, the Buddha, responding to his people's needs as he could understand them. And so he said very different things at different times in different places. And so there's not really one sort of central Buddhist teaching. This is the Buddhist teaching. Sometimes people say there is, just to kind of simplify and make it sound like a little more, I don't know what. But, you know, like we often say that about the Four Noble Truths, which is a central Buddhist teaching, but it doesn't come up that often, actually. It's in the very first sermon. So we say, a priori, that must be the most important, but is it? It's hard to know. So he had many different teachings. And one of the things they compared the Buddha to was like a doctor. The Buddha was seen as like a doctor. So the doctor, you know, a doctor who is a skilled, I learned this word from the medical students, a skilled diagnostician. A skilled diagnostician, you know, just responds with the right teaching. based on what they understand of the person's illness. And so it's interesting to read the Buddha's teachings. They're sort of all over the place. They're sort of repetitive. It's sort of hard to get a handle on them because we want them to be very simple, very condensed. And he didn't really work that way. But although his teachings are quite diverse and quite varied, and he especially used many different metaphors and similes, you know, one time, a different one another time. So although the expression was varied, the purpose was what was singular. The purpose of was what was really singular about the Buddha's teaching. And the purpose is the release from stress and suffering. And then all the positive benefits that brings for each person and for all beings together when somebody is released from stress, released from a sort of, Anita, when she was here, said it's like the mind builds walls around us. She talked about different ways the mind builds walls. It's released from these walls, from this prison. So the Buddha was always speaking to that purpose. And he was famous for not wanting to answer questions that didn't really serve that purpose. And it's implied that he had this, you know, incredible enlightenment experience and some really deep insight into the nature of how the universe works. And so the implication is he maybe might have known the answer to some of the sort of more metaphorical or metaphysical or just sort of why questions, right? We have that question, why? The Buddha mostly didn't answer if people said why. He would stay silent or say something else. He was interested in how. So we have this goal of a kind of freedom. And of course you can't really engage a path to anywhere unless you know where you're starting from. So that's why there's an emphasis in Buddhism in really understanding our experience as it is, very honestly. And so that's why sometimes we hear people say, or we hear have this idea that Buddhism is like about suffering. It's about trouble. And I suppose that's true insofar as often our day-to-day life is about sort of avoiding the acknowledgement of the way things really are. So maybe we need to bring up strongly one side to kind of wake people up. Like, wow, you know, all is not right in Suffer City here, you know. But it's not really that life is suffering. It's that we have to see life honestly and realistically so that we can walk on the path, so that we know where we're standing. Try walking if you don't know where you're standing. And the Buddha's vision is much bigger than just you can learn some new tools and feel a little better. His vision is actually complete release from stress and suffering. Freedom in the middle of our life, no matter what happens. Now, part of the nature of our language is that it always divides things, usually in two, right? It's just the nature of words. You can't have the word good wouldn't mean anything if you didn't have the word bad. The word small wouldn't mean anything if you didn't have the word large. And so our language, which we need, divides things, right, into good and bad, what I like, what I don't like, and then most importantly, me and you. Our language does this, and then our language is what our thoughts seem to more or less happen in. Our thoughts seem to be somewhat symbolic and visually, and visual and somewhat linguistic, and people seem to vary a little bit there. And so part of this, prison sounds a little harsh, but part of the mechanism that we can be more free of is this process of dividing things up to the point that we ourselves are divided up, divided in half in some way. And so the Buddha was not saying No pain, no coughing, no things not going the way you thought they would go. He was saying it's possible to be to have freedom. Even where it's going exactly the opposite way of what your consciousness predicted. Which is so jarring for us, right? We expect a very orderly universe, which seems to be another aspect of language. We expect things to go the way they're going to go. And when it doesn't go that way, it's surprising and shocking to us. And so the vision of the Buddha is that even then, it's just the next moment. We can be fully present and free in that moment and able to respond in that moment. So on the one hand, we start with suffering. And it's a big problem being a human being. And it is, you know, we have to admit this, right? It's pretty hard being a human being. Pretty hard being a person. It's pretty hard making a living. It's pretty hard having relationships. It's pretty damn hard running a sangha, let me tell you. You know? We think that way, right? We think that way. And at the same time, it's perfectly just exactly the way it is, right? It's perfectly exactly the way it is. And that gap we see between, it's hard and it's easy, seems to have to do with some wall there in between what it is and what it's supposed to be, or what we wanted it to be, or what we expected it to be, or what our parents told us it should be. Something like this. So there seems to be like this tiny gap that we can barely see or not see at all, which is like made of concrete, super, you know, kryptonite or something. Yeah. So in one sense, the Buddha's path is, how can we walk in a way that allows this tiny gap to finally close, and to just be with life, with contentment and joy, no matter what it throws at us. So we feel far away, and yet we're really close. So there's some apparent paradoxes, and there are language that divides things into this and that, makes it difficult to understand. I think one of the greatest gifts of Buddhist sort of logic and epistemology to the world is maybe we can change this habit, if we can work with this inner habit of it's this or it's that. I'm happy or I'm sad. I like this or I don't like this. You're my friend or you're not my friend. What if we could turn that or into an and? Into an and. So it's this and it's that. I'm happy and I'm sad. You're my friend and not my friend. Or maybe it's even more than that. There's actually four steps in Buddhist logic. It could be this and that. Or what if it's not this and that? What if it's not this and not that? What if it's none of those? Then where do you have left to stand? And so this list I want to bring up tonight is just sort of a way of working with the mind, taking up different sort of angles on this question of how do we divide the world? How do we make walls? How do we make experience as it is into suffering and pain? And that was the sort of the thrust of the Buddha's teaching, is there's a method, there are steps, there's something you can actually do. But then what happened in later Buddhism, which was a wonderful sort of softening of that, because then the problem is you say, oh, okay, I get it. I'm ill, I have to work hard and do it right, follow the instructions, and then I'll be better, right? So then you have that, which maybe is true in a way, but maybe it creates new problems for us, because then we have so much to do, we have to work so hard, and we might fail. Later Buddhism also looked at the other side of this, which is that we're already complete. That gap isn't even there. We made it up. We're already whole. So they have these ideas like Buddha nature and lots of different names for our wholeness. And that is what's emphasized in the Zen tradition. So I don't know if you've noticed, but there hasn't been a whole lot of instructions or steps or things to do around here in practice, right? It's just sit down. Follow the breath. I mean, there's some instructions, you know. You go to the teacher, it's some words are exchanged probably, but the Zen tradition emphasizes the side of wholeness, which is wonderful. But it seems to me we need both. We need steps that we can actually take on the path and a lived, felt understanding that we're already whole, we're already complete, we were never sick to begin with. And Dogen is always writing about that. That's why we like to study Dogen. As baffling as he is, it's because he's taking both of these sides at once. And our mind, which wants it to be this way or that way, is like, what did he just say? I got to read that paragraph again. I don't get it. And so it's in everything we chant by him. It's in everything we study. When we studied Genjo Koan last year, it's all through Genjo Koan. And he often introduces a text by bringing up this point. So like Fukan Zazengi that we chant here on Saturdays sometimes, which is his kind of instruction manual for Zen practice, starts out this way. The way is basically perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent upon practice and realization? The Dharma vehicle is free and untrammeled. What need is there for concentrated effort? Indeed, the whole whole body is far beyond the world's dust. I mean, it's already pure, perfect. Who could believe in a means to brush it clean? It's never apart from one, right where one is. What is the use of going off here and there to practice? Remember chanting that? And then he says, and yet, if there's the slightest discrepancy, the way is as distant as heaven from earth. If the least like or dislike arises, the mind is lost in confusion. So there's preferences, right, from John's talk. But even deeper than, like, preferences almost sounds like, and preferences is a perfect good word for this, but preferences makes it sound like it's just sort of this mental baggage, like, oh, I have too many preferences. If only I had less preferences, I could just sort of, you know, be better. But it seems to be a much deeper thing than that, right? It's down to our roots, you know? It's like not quite believing that everything's okay. Not quite believing that the Dharma vehicle is free, untrammeled, pure, and that we are the Dharma vehicle already. And so what's wonderful about Zen is we can actually have experiences in Zazen or other times. And we don't always even notice them, but these moments, you know, these moments when everything is just at rest, is just fine. Maybe just for an instant, you know, or a breath, or a day of Sesshin, or who knows. So it's this kind of funny thing, you know, how do we hold these two things that seem sort of a little bit at odds with each other? On the one hand, you're fine the way you are. Things are complete. Just kind of let go of this idea that something's wrong, you know. On the one hand. The other hand, things are not right, you know. Human beings are got wired up in a funny way. We need to do some very skillful, very wise discernment, very steady effort. We need to work. We need to actually make an effort. And these things at the same time. So I've been enjoying a book. I brought it. Good. Sometimes it's really good to read a book that's written for in a nice, simple way. So I've been enjoying this book called Wide Awake, a Buddhist Guide for Teens. A good Buddhist Guide for Teens. We should all read this book, actually. It's on the Brooklyn Zen Center, like, reading list. I was hearing about how they use this in Brooklyn. And I said, okay, I'll read it. And it's great. It's a very clear book on the practice. I feel like I'm just sort of mumbling. This woman is just like very clear. There's lots of examples about boyfriends and girlfriends too, which is fun, because it's for teens. But a very clear book. And I wanted to share with you the way, her name is Diana Winston, and I wanted to share with you the way she kind of describes and works with this apparent dichotomy between the work we have to do and the ways that we just need to let go. No work. She writes, in Buddhism, we talk about the potential for becoming enlightened, or of fully waking up. But what does this mean? In the Buddhist tradition, the Sanskrit word nirvana is used to mean a state of full awakening. The word literally means coolness and is associated with peace and freedom. Nirvana is seen as the ultimate goal of Buddhism. What the Buddha achieves under the Bodhi tree is nirvana. However, many misconceptions surround the words nirvana and enlightenment. Some people imagine if I reach enlightenment, the world will explode into white light, or I'll become one with everyone, or I'll have omniscience and know how to help all beings on the planet, or all my problems will be solved, or I'll be extremely powerful and loved. Some schools of Buddhism say every time we have a moment of awakening, like those moments of self-awareness, when we're fully present here and now, we're having a little nirvana. And in that case, to reach nirvana, all we have to do is practice waking up in our lives as much as possible, moment after moment, time after time. The late Thai master Ajahn Buddhadasa, who coined the phrase little nirvana, said, "Nirvana can be present here and now by taking your breath in cool and letting it out cool. It is the realm that cools down the heart, quenches the thirst, and extinguishes the suffering existing in our daily life. Automatically, without us necessarily being conscious of it, it really is a nourishing process for our life all the time." And note how he says, not necessarily conscious of it. So it's not just like the little me working here. Anyway, she goes on. Another Buddhist school considers nirvana to be the eradication of three mental weeds: greed, hatred, and delusion. These nasty plants grow in our minds, and upon enlightenment are finally ripped out by their roots and never grow again. In their place, generosity, love, and wisdom thrive. They say that the plant is uprooted in stages, a little at a time, more like weeding a garden over many seasons, for many years. So other schools of Buddhism say that the truth is we're already enlightened. It is our true nature, but we have forgotten. Often this existing enlightenment is called our Buddha nature, the whole radiant inner self that cannot be changed by anything external. In some traditions, our minds are compared to the vast blue sky, extending as far as the eye can see. However, clouds and rainstorms can pass by and cover our true nature. The Zen master Hakuin said, "Although there are countless teachings that instruct us how to obtain enlightenment, the ultimate instruction is there simply is no teaching that is superior to the true practice of awakening to one's own nature." I read Hakuin again. "Although there are countless teachings that instruct us how to obtain enlightenment, the ultimate instruction is there is no teaching that is superior to the true practice of awakening to one's true nature, one's own nature." Diana Winston goes on, "How do we make sense of these seemingly contradictory teachings? If I'm already enlightened, why do spiritual practice? Or if I have a lot of work to do to free my mind from greed, hate, and delusion, how could I already be enlightened? I like to hold the two views together. On the one hand, I diligently practice meditation and waking up in daily life while remembering the incredible human potential for full awakening. Imagine, this is imagination thing. One day my mind may be completely free of greed, hatred, and delusion. As I practice, I get more and more tastes of free mind. On the other hand, as I develop in my spiritual path, I remember that an awakened heart and mind is true human nature. How could it be otherwise? I try to accept myself exactly as I am. I remind myself that even if I don't feel enlightened, being awake is the natural condition of mind, which I can experience from time to time. And through practice increasingly more often, I feel this. Whatever I encounter on my path, no matter how challenging, cannot possibly cover up the pure radiance of my heart." And so as we'll see when I finally spring this list on you, faith is in there. So this faith in the teaching, in our true heart, in whatever you want to call it, seems to be a condition for engaging with this stepping. the steady practice. So one of the things I've done to kind of explore this teaching, I've read a couple of books, and I did list, we're going to talk about this, continue talking about this a lot, and we're going to talk about it in the study retreat. Hopefully I won't get too tired of it, but in the description on the website of the study, just study retreat, I describe what the books are. So if you want to look up the books, I won't tell you now, because who remembers these things, but I got books in two very different traditions, which is neat. One is by a Chinese Chan master, and the other is by an American monk in the Thai forest tradition. So very different parts of Buddhism appreciate this list. And so in addition to just sort of studying it and reading the commentaries and trying to explore this in my life, and some of these lists I'd studied before, I concocted a practice, a home practice. Because one of the things I've really come to appreciate about our ritual practice is there's a way it seems to plant seeds in the mind. You chant something over and over and over again, like that Dogen piece. Sort of gets in there, ready to pop out when you need it. And I thought that would be a great way for us to kind of make these lists come alive, not just read them or talk about them, but to chant them and bow with them and recite them and bring them forward as objects of spiritual practice and spiritual power. So I want to end my talk with a little chanting and bowing, and then I'll hand out the list at the very end. Okay? So let's all stand up. And let's do, you know how we do the kind of staggered cushion thing for the full moon ceremony? Nate Tallis can just model how to do that. So we're going to do a bunch of prostrations, so it's good to have a mat.
So this row, along with me, you just pull the cushion one width over, and the fourth one.
Stand right behind it, facing the front.
Yeah, stand behind the cushion. When you're bowing, so you want your shoulder cushion off the mat. From the side of you.
So this is what I concocted. I don't know if this is a traditional practice or not. The commentaries by Chan Master Sheng Yan talked about doing lots of bowing, so I'm going to assume that this is perfectly great Zen thing. Bodhi Pakshika Dharma. Oh, I need a bell. So when you hear the bell, we're bowing. And if it's too much to do all the prostrations, 37, right? We can just do standing bow. Bodhipakshika Dharma. We venerate the three treasures and give thanks for this path of training and practice. We vow to practice the aids to awakening with our whole hearts, bodies, and minds. Continuously throughout day and night for the benefit of all beings. The 37 A's to awakening are the four foundations of mindfulness, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of sensations and reactions, mindfulness of thoughts and emotions, mindfulness of patterns and habits, the four proper exertions, guarding against unwholesome states, guarding, abandoning unwholesome states,
cultivating wholesome states. Maintaining wholesome states. The four bases of freedom. The concentration of desire. The concentration of persistence. The concentration of intention. The concentration of discrimination. The five wholesome roots, the root of faith. The root of diligence. The root of mindfulness. The root of samadhi. The root of wisdom. The five wholesome strengths. The strength of faith. The strength of diligence. The strength of mindfulness. The strength of samadhi. The strength of wisdom. The seven factors of enlightenment, the factor of mindfulness, the factor of discernment, the factor of diligence. The factor of joy. The factor of lightness and ease. The factor of samadhi. The factor of equanimity. The Noble Eightfold Path. The path of right view. The path of right intention. The path of right speech. The path of right action. The path of right livelihood. The path of right effort. The path. of right mindfulness. The path of right samadhi. Now we have renewed our vow to practice the 37 steps of the Bodhipakshika Dharma. May the benefit of this ongoing practice bring joy, wisdom, and understanding for ourselves and all beings in all directions. May we, through this patient effort, enter the fullness of Buddha's way.
Three.